For high school athletes, getting scouted to play on a big league sports team is the dream. They hope someday recruiters will be standing on the sidelines watching during practice, or come to their games and sign them up for college teams, or even sometimes professional ones. That happened to 16-year-old Kyle Giersdorf. He goes by the nickname Booga, but the recruiting process was a bit different. Giersdorf wasn't out on a field.
Yo.
He was in his parents' house in Pottstown, Pennsylvania, sitting in front of his computer, playing the video game Fortnite. He'd been streaming his games almost daily for Amazon's Twitch, a website for gamers. And that's where a scout for an esports team called the Sentinels saw him play. He signed a one-year contract with the Sentinels back in March. And that paid off for Giersdorf and the Sentinels almost immediately.
Time. The Fortnite World Cup Finals ends right here.
This was in July at the Arthur Ashe Stadium in Flushing, New York. That's the same stadium where tennis players compete in the U.S. Open. Giersdorf was there on the field for the first Fortnite World Cup, and it was a spectacle.
Spread of players across the screen. There's your top 10 on the left side.
The top players in the world sat on the field behind computer monitors, side by side, playing against each other in the virtual game, which was then projected onto multiple Megatrons for thousands of fans in the stands. Booga's parents were in the audience, of course, as well, cheering him on. And they weren't the only ones. Fortnite has about 250 million registered users, and more than a million of them were streaming the World Cup competition.
Beats him, your Fortnite world champion, Booga!
And the prize money was worth a lot.
$3 million richer.
$3 million. Of that, Giersdorf took home about $2.4 million. The Sentinels got to keep the rest, according to people familiar with the matter. But even so, Booga and other esport competitors like him are living the teenage dream, getting paid to play video games. Epic, the company that makes Fortnite, isn't the only game in town. Activision Blizzard and Take-Two Interactive Software have launched professional leagues around their games. Electronic Arts has a FIFA eWorld Cup, a video game version of the Soccer World Cup, with 32 players competing in multiple rounds until one country player comes out on top. Revenue from esports is expected to climb around 26% this year to reach about $1.2 billion. But while it's a fast-growing niche, it's still just a small part of the global video game industry, which is estimated to be worth $150 billion. From the Wall Street Journal, this is The Future of Everything. I'm Kateri Yoakum. This episode is part three of our highlights series, where we bring you the best from the Wall Street Journal's Tech Live conference in Laguna Beach, California. For 3 days, Wall Street Journal editors gathered alongside leaders in the tech community to discuss everything from the future of artificial intelligence to data privacy. Today, we're focusing on the future of games.
Hi, I'm Jason Gay, and I'm a sports columnist for the Wall Street Journal. I'm speaking with Andrew Wilson, the CEO of Electronic Arts. Electronic Arts, or EA, is a global leader in the gaming world, especially in sports games. They're the ones who make Madden NFL, FIFA, Need for Speed, Apex, and of course, The Sims. The company has more than 300 million registered players around the world. And last year, 2018, it posted a net revenue of $5.15 billion. Andrew spoke to us about how esports, mobile gaming on social networks, and mixed reality games are changing the way people play. And also, his thoughts on the industry overall.
I want to ask you right at the top what you're excited about right now. Like, what is happening in your trade? It might be something you are doing, but it might be something somebody else is doing. What is getting you excited right now in gaming?
If you think about how cloud has kind of changed the way we consume everything, right? So we watch more TV and more music and we listen to more music. And our belief is that we're actually going to start to be able to blur the lines between real and virtual with the cloud. Okay. So you get to a place where you get up in the morning and every activity you perform through the day has some kind of payoff inside of a game. You might run to work, which means you have more energy in FIFA. You might have a dozen eggs in the fridge, which means your Sims are fed. You might drive fast, so your Need for Speed game is better. You may interact with a whole bunch of people, so you have more power inside of an RPG. So this blurring of the lines between kind of the real and the virtual, kind of moving gaming from a discrete experience to an indiscrete experience.
So are there applications for businesses to actually gamify the workplace? You know, people showing up for the 9:30 meeting on time?
Well, I think that's happening already. I mean, and we see that in schooling, too, where we use gamification inside of schooling. Education is becoming more compelling for a new generation. So inevitably, it happens in our workplace, that's for sure.
Do you think that people can burn out on it, or do you think that that is something that will stay, the idea that people want that kind of competitive, you know, metabolism where they gamify the experience?
Social interaction and competition are kind of two of the most powerful motivators of human behavior that are positive. So guilt, obligation, addiction cause us as human beings to do all kinds of things until such point in time as we kind of go, actually, this is just really bad. And we kick the habit cold turkey and then we tell all of our friends not to do it as well. But social interaction and competition are the two things that we don't get tired of. It kind of drives us throughout our lives. And so really at the very core of gaming are these two core positive motivators of human behavior. And provided you do it right and you build over time and you get the rewards and benefits of those two things, then it's not something you burn out on. It's actually something that enriches and extends and enhances your life.
What's an example of something that you've experimented with yourself that you've been surprised has been a very sort of exciting, satisfying gaming experience?
Candy Crush? I mean, who would have thought, like, doing this and doing this? I mean, here we are 5 years, 6 years later, and we're still doing it.
Yeah, yeah. It's a good segue to the next question, which is that I think of gaming as a business where every now and again there are true phenomenons that just cross the culture. And what is it like, and you've had some of them, what's that like to have a game that isn't just a business success but just sort of vaults into the cultural conversation?
I think every day you get up to build entertainment, and your hope is that you can entertain, you know, tens or hundreds of millions of people. I mean, that, as the purveyors and creators of entertainment, I think that's all of our objective when we get up in the morning. Every now and then it actually happens.
Yeah.
And all kinds of good things come from that, and all kinds of challenges come from that. We had a game earlier this year called Apex Legends. We brought 50 million people into that game in a month. Mm-hmm. And that's a wonderful thing. I mean, that's mind-blowing, and we're running around the office cheering about, you know, how compelling this game is. And then all of a sudden you discover there are all kinds of negative manifestations of that kind of broad appeal.
Yeah, what are
And you
some?
Get cheaters in the space, and you get people trying to counterfeit currency in the space, and you get bullies in the space. And then all of these kind of negative manifestations of human behavior that we see in the real world, quite frankly, also manifest at scale in a world that has this many people interacting with it. And so there's a whole nother vector of work that we have to do to keep that experience fun and safe and enjoyable for the people who play.
Yeah, how do you see around corners to predict and anticipate what kinds of, you know, shenanigans might happen with a game?
Well, we've been doing it a long time.
Yeah.
We spent a lot of time thinking about if we were bad people, what would we try and do? We go out and hire some bad people to see what and ask them what would they do.
Yeah, that works.
And then the other thing is we've written a whole program set that really looks at human behavior over time and human conversation over time. Mm-hmm. And we're getting better and better through machine learning at predicting where positive energy kind of turns negative or where positive conversation turns negative and kind of dealing with it kind of upstream. For the longest time, we had to wait until some catastrophic action would happen inside the ecosystem.
Right.
Whether that was a breach of the currency or whether that was some large-scale bullying or some cheat mechanism that just made the whole experience feel unfair. And so we had to write a whole bunch of proprietary software so that we could start to get better predictive analytics around that. And again, it is wholly imperfect at this point. But I would say we're catching it further upstream now than we were a long time ago. If we take a product like FIFA Ultimate Team, so anyone who knows our FIFA game, it's based on soccer. We have a card trading mechanic much the way like card collection in the real world. We had a situation where we had state-sponsored operators out of Russia and North Korea and some other places kind of come in and breach the ecosystem. And that was a really big deal for us.
Sure.
And you see it, and it was, you know, it's probably a $50 million swing in the economy.
Wow.
Which is not insignificant. A year later, our security team had built this whole new set of software. They tried again, and they were unable to breach the system. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of just in a 12-month process. And so this is the new frontier for us.
I should mention with FIFA, I mean, there are people, I'm a sports writer by trade, and there are people in our country who believe that your game deserves at least partial credit for the incredibly increased soccer fluency in the United States. Do you see that as well?
I partial credit, maybe. I think it's. I think the relationship that we have with our sports governing bodies and sports teams and sports leagues and sports players is very symbiotic in nature. And in this country in particular, as the Premier League and the Bundesliga and La Liga and FIFA itself kind of started to push into the marketplace, what we gave people with our FIFA game is that direct emotional contact with the sport they were growing to love on a day-to-day, moment-to-moment basis in between game broadcasts. And the combination of, you know, experiencing the real-world game and being able to participate and interact in the context of the virtual world game and build what is a 365-day experience, that grows the sport. And we'll, you know, we work with the NBA to do that internationally, we work with the NFL to do that internationally, and we certainly work with the soccer leagues to do that in this country.
When you run into a professional athlete, do they complain about their number ever to you?
If I had my phone here, I would show you the text. I've had the great fortune. I've been in this business for a long time. I worked in our EA Sports division for a long time, and I've met a lot of athletes and athlete managers over the years, and I've got to spend time with them, as you probably have with your profession. I would tell you, I never get a text that says, wow, that, you know, it's awesome, the game's great, I love how my hairdo looks. It's all about, you know, 88, are you kidding me? This guy's 89, this guy's 91. And it is constant.
Yeah.
When we launch Madden stats or we launch FIFA stats, it is constant for a number of weeks. And I, you know, try and appease them, and I send it out. I've sent it to the dev team, don't worry, they're gonna fix it for you. Deflect.
Are you
Deflect.
The final authority on if someone's number can get bumped?
I have no control over people's numbers whatsoever. Are you kidding? If I called the dev team, I'd say, now listen, you need to change this person's number, they would laugh at me.
Now, you are decidedly in the pro sports gaming business, but California recently passed a law called the Fair Pay to Play Act, in which college athletes would be entitled to negotiate for compensation for their name, image, and likeness. Now, this harkens back to when you guys did used to do college sports games. Does this law and the ability to be able to compensate athletes open up the possibility we might see those games down the road?
I think there are many, many tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of players right now. I hope that's the case, as in video game players. Yeah. I think aside from texts about, you know, player ratings, the other sports-driven emails and texts I get is, please bring back college football. Please bring back college basketball. I think what's happening in California might be a start. Mm. My guess is it's a fairly long journey from here. It's a complicated puzzle to solve.
It doesn't even take place. I mean, it doesn't even get enacted until 2023.
And so our position is we would love to build a game. Mm-hmm. If there's a world where, you know, the folks who govern these things are able to solve for how to pay players for the use of their name and likeness and stats and data, we would jump at the opportunity to build a game in a heartbeat.
Wow. What sport has been the hardest to translate to a video game environment?
You know, they all have their own complexities.
Yeah.
You know, building an NFL playbook is pretty complex. When we used to build a football playbook for college football, that was really complex. There's 120 schools that used to go on that game.
Right.
Building nuanced data across 16,000 players inside of FIFA is complex.
Yeah.
But probably the most complex so far is grappling inside of UFC.
No kidding.
So once you have, you know, two athletes kind of impacting each other in NFL or in basketball or whatever it might be, it's all a very structured way you impact. In MMA, if anyone watches the UFC, there's anything but structure in how these human beings come together. And so putting that together in a video game has probably been the most complex. But more than that, giving people the feeling that they have control. And so our job is giving you the feeling that you are in absolute control over something of which we give you great assistance.
That's a really interesting one. So you're talking about when they go to the mat and they're grappling or doing jiu-jitsu moves and things like that.
Yes.
That's harder than the striking part of it.
Yeah.
We are now in a world where video gaming is a mature industry. You know, it did not ruin the planet. Kids are still playing outside. In fact, there are kids getting college scholarships to now for being talented at video gaming. You're always going to have your skeptics and critics and people want to see regulation. How much of your job is dedicated to that stuff?
To talking to the skeptics?
Or no, just, you know, sort of the idea of, you know, fending off, you know, people who want to regulate your industry.
I feel like before I worked in video games, which I've done for 20 years, I worked the internet. Mm. And I remember having to go to, you know, I was in Australia and I was going to Babcock and Brown and Macquarie trying to raise capital to do startup things. And I would stand in this boardroom as a kid dressed in a cheap suit saying, you know, this internet thing is not a fad. It's going to be a pretty big deal. And you would see these very skeptical people on the other side of the boardroom table think about giving me money. And then at some point, actually right before the bubble burst, as it turned out, everybody recognized that the internet wasn't a fad. It was actually going to be fundamentally transformative for humanity. And I left the internet and went into video games, and everybody said, don't do that. It's not a real job. You know, it's for, you know, 14-year-old boys in their mother's basements, and that, you know, it's like it's the next hula hoop. As it turns out, 20 years later, we are the biggest entertainment industry on the planet. Yeah. We're the fastest growing entertainment industry on the planet. I think today we're about 130 billion, 150 in the next couple of years, and 200 in not that long from now. And so I think it's less now about, you know, is this going to be a real job? Is this going to be a real industry? Is this meaningful to humanity? We entertain about 2.6 billion players. Now it's really about how do we do that responsibly?
Yeah.
And how do we think about, you know, parents who effectively feel like they've lost control of their child's digital lives? What is it that we can do as an industry to help them regain that control? Yeah. Whether that's with education or tools or whatever it might be. And I would say that's what I spend a lot of my time on now, is how do we ensure that this industry, which is now so important to so many, actually does that responsibly.
Well, esports is a nascent industry. That's still, you know, we're still trying to figure that out. And I see a lot of optimism about the idea of making esports translate into standard television. The idea of, like, you know, instead of watching Monday Night Football, you watch Monday Night Esports. That's had, you know, mixed success. Do you think we'll ever get to that environment, or is it sort of purposeless to just focus on that because of all the actions on Twitch and other places like that?
Well, I mean, where you watch it, I think, is ultimately immaterial.
Yeah.
The generation who's watching will decide where and how they want to watch, whether that's on broadcast television or through Twitch or YouTube or whatever it might be. The notion that we're going to watch people play video games, that is absolutely going to happen.
Yeah.
Again, I lived in the UK for a while. They packed stadiums with people throwing darts at a wall. I lived in Canada for 6 years. I remember the first time I moved to Vancouver. I'm sitting in the hotel with my wife, and I put, you know, the TSN, which is effectively ESPN for Canada, on the television. There are these people with these brooms and this thing, and they're sliding it down ice. I remember calling the front desk saying, what the hell is this sport? And it's curling, and as it turns out, it's the national sport of Canada, and lots of people watch it. As human beings, we will watch anything where the best in the world are doing it. We understand how you win, and the stakes are high.
Yeah.
And that is true for esports in the same way it's true for darts and curling.
I'm sure the curlers will appreciate the shout-out. You had a competitor, Blizzard, that was recently intertwined in a controversy in which one of their esport athletes expressed support for Hong Kong protests and ended up being sanctioned because of that. You know, we've seen with the NBA, this has been a hot issue, and China is a valuable market, but it's not going to be one without challenges. How does esports navigate that?
You know, again, I think, and even on the panel before Spot the Robot Dog, I think Mark Cuban, you know, said it's beyond him to kind of weigh into the sovereignty of a nation, mm-hmm. how we think about that. And I would say the same thing. I would go one step further to say, as an industry, we are an adolescent. You know, if you're in the oil business, you've been around 100 years dealing with geopolitical conversations. We've been around for 40 years, and only really in a material way for about 20 years. I don't think we're mature enough to effectively weigh into these conversations yet, and I'm not sure that we ever will be.
Mm-hmm.
But what I would say, you know, as an industry who's found itself at the center of, you know, the gender equality debate or the racial equality debate and a number of other culturally relevant conversations over the last 24 months, largely because this thing we create is at the center of so many people's lives, we as a company have had to make a series of decisions. In almost all cases, I'd like to say we've not made a single political decision. What we've made is a values-based decision. Mm-hmm. And that's important for the people who work at our company, that's important for the games we make, and it's important for the 500 million people that we interact with on a regular basis who play our games. And those values are based on inclusion, freedom of speech, diversity, gender equality, racial equality, and so many other things. And all I would say is, as we think about, you know, the creation of video games, the thing about the playing of video games or the competing in the context of video games, as a company, as an industry, we're going to have to lean back into those core values. And I don't know that we'll always get it right, but that's all we've got right now.
I want to open it up. We just have about 5 minutes for a couple of quick questions. If anybody in the audience, who's gentleman right here.
Hi, Alan Fazio from Houlihan Lokey. So I started using EA products when I was in college. It was a 5.25 diskette that I bought at Toys R Us. Now my son's in college, and he's on an esports team. And during that evolution, the way you monetize your product has changed dramatically. We've gone from I cobbled together enough money to buy the product, and now we're looking at games that I have to spend 99 cents on a fluffy backpack. And gamers are very vocal. If you pay to play to change the game where you can beat me because you pay more for it, that doesn't go over very well. But if you're going to augment your character with some type of backpack or pants, have at it. And now you're seeing these games bring in millions of dollars in currency, and Blizzard kind of started it. How does EA think about balancing the price of a game and the future potential of revenue within the game?
What I would say is the sentiment of players in terms of monetization is actually different by geography. So there's some markets in Asia where actually the ability to buy the option to win is completely accepted and seen as a kind of form of status. In other parts of Asia, and the US is much like this, the notion that you can buy something to win is generally frowned upon. Although in Ultimate Team, FIFA Ultimate Team, which is this buying and selling of cards and players, you kind of get some of that. Yet it's a really great business for us. It works out. It's a really great business for consumers. So if you think about, if you take a game like FIFA that costs you $50, for all people who participate in Ultimate Team, which is the buying and selling and collecting of cards, they spend on average about another $50. So that's a total of $100. And they play that game 365 days a year. In the old world, me, you, we in that time would probably buy four or five games. So depending on how much your game was, somewhere between $50 and $60, typically you could be into it for $300 plus. So the business that we are in the context of Ultimate Team actually gives you the ability to extend and enhance your experience through what we call microtransactions. But the value proposition to you is significantly better than the alternative, which was go out and buy four or five games. Where we've got to is it really comes down to four key pillars: choice, fairness, value, and fun. If we make you do something, we don't give you the ability to just play and earn, that's going to be a problem. If we cause someone to have a benefit inside of a game where you don't have choice, and so therefore the game feels unfair, you're going to come undone. In everything we do, we have to feel like if you're going to give us an $1 or $10,000 or $100,000, you have to feel like you get value for that. As human beings, we buy all kinds of really expensive things. I had a conversation yesterday with a person who's going to spend $300,000 on a car. I can't imagine spending $300,000 on a car, but he was giddy with excitement about it and feels like he's getting tremendous value for whatever reason. And so understanding how value works is really important, whether you ask for a dollar or $100, and we're spending a lot of energy around that, not just on a broad industry level, but on a cohort by cohort level. And the last thing, it's got to be fun. It can't be a grind. And I would say we have franchises that have got this and done this really well. We've had free-to-play games in mobile and in Asia since 2006. FIFA Ultimate Team is a business that I launched when I led that team, which is buying and selling, collecting digital cards in the same way you would have trading cards in, for the last 50 years. We launched that in 2007. And the sentiment, the community sentiment around those games is really, really strong. Every now and then we get it wrong. And I would say a couple of years ago, we had a game where we did get it wrong on a series of industry games that had got it wrong. And as an industry, we had to learn. But on a go-forward basis, we've built a new architecture and infrastructure and framework for how we build monetization models in our games, and it's all built on those four pillars: choice, fairness, value, fun.
Andrew, thank you very, very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Electronic Arts CEO Andrew Wilson speaking with Wall Street Journal sports columnist Jason Gay at our Tech Live conference in Laguna Beach, California. The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. This episode was produced with help from Jason Gay, Sarah Needleman, and Anthony Green. Our technical director is Jacob Gorski. Thanks to our editors on the live journalism team, Yuni Kim, Nikki Waller, and Kim Last. And special thanks to conference organizers Helen Bassett, Andrea Acosta, Mary Chen, Aliyah Al-Junid, and Robin Wood-Saylor. If you like what you heard, be sure to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening. I'm Kateri Yoakum.